Thank you everyone for coming this morning, beautiful morning. And we're extremely pleased to have as one of our fellows here at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies, Alex Watson, who you can see has come from Ashoka University to spend the term here with us and has been wonderfully received. Everyone's so happy to have him here, and everything he says is fabulous.
So, no pressure.
It's just spontaneous applause. But and so we're extremely happy to have him speaking today, particularly about this topic, Indian logic and the existence of God, the atheist arguments, for one of the Shiv Dasani seminars that he's giving this term. Very pleased. Thank you very much, Alex. And we will turn over to you.
Thank you very much, Jessica. And thank you all for coming. Well, I know you're all very busy with many demands on your time. So this is the first of two lectures, both called Indian Logic and the Existence of God. Today we'll be looking at the atheist's arguments. And in 2 weeks' time, week five at this time, we'll be looking at how the theist responds to these arguments. Now, as I look out at you all in the audience, I can see some experts on Indian logic, and I can see some people who are totally unfamiliar with Indian logic, and my worry is that what I present will be banal for the experts, but it will be maybe a bit too much too quickly for people totally unfamiliar with Indian logic. So if you end up falling in either of those two categories, I apologise in advance. What I'll try and do is keep everyone on board, but also offer something for the experts. So anyone who knows anything about Indian logic knows that this is the paradigmatic inference. You're looking at the mountain on the horizon, you see some smoke, you have previous knowledge that wherever there is smoke there is fire, acquired from observing the fire that you make in the kitchen to cook over, the fire that you light to warm your house, the fire that you see in the nearby forest. From all of your previous experience to smoke and fire, you realize that wherever there's smoke, there's fire. And so you reach the conclusion that there's fire on the mountain, even though you can't see any fire on the mountain, you can just see smoke. Now you might think, but why can't you sometimes have smoke without fire? Don't you sometimes look at something burning and you can't see any fire, you can only see smoke? Well, the situation that's being assumed here is that even in cases like that, there's fire causing the smoke. So the empirical situation on which this logical claim that presence of smoke implies presence of fire is based is that is illustrated by this Venn diagram, where the small circle represents the domain occupied by the set of all instances of smoke in the universe. The big circle is the domain occupied by all instances of fire in the universe. And the thought is that you never find smoke without fire. Wherever you're located in the small circle, that's pervaded by the domain of fire. But there are sometimes instances of fire without smoke. For example, if the wood is very dry, or red hot metal is given in these texts as an example of fire without smoke. Now, the basic, I said that was the paradigmatic inference. The basic structure of all inferences in Indian philosophy was this. Something S possesses property X. Whatever possesses X possesses Y. Therefore, this thing S possesses Y. And there's a bit of terminology that we'll have to acquaint ourselves with. S is known as the subject in Sanskrit, paksha or dharmin. X is known as the reasoned property in Sanskrit, hetu. Y is known as the property to be proved in Sanskrit, sadhya. And for the rest of the talk, I'll use the English word subject, but I'll use hetu and sadhya, just because they're quicker to say than reason property and property to be proved. So make sure you can remember that hetu is the reason property, sadhya is the property to be proved. So, given that that's the basic structure, that all inferences, any candidate inference has to fit into that structure, we should just slightly rephrase the fire inference as the mountain possesses smoke, whatever possesses smoke possesses fire, therefore the mountain possesses fire. So looking at that fire inference, what is the subject of that inference? Anyone? I'm here.
The mountain.
Yeah, the mountain is the subject. What's the hetu, the reason property?
The smoke.
Yeah, and what's the sadhya?
Fire.
Yeah, exactly. Although this particular, this fire, smoke-fire inference slightly disguises the fact that the hetu and the sadhya must always be properties. S is always a thing that contains properties, and X and Y, hetu and sadhya, are always properties. So perhaps, strictly speaking, we should say that the hetu is not smoke, but something like the property of possessing smoke, the property of giving off smoke. And the sadhya is, strictly speaking, not fire, since fire is a thing rather than a property. The sadhya, strictly speaking, is being fiery or being on fire. Property that a thing can have. Now, there are two main ways in which one can challenge the validity of an inference. One can claim that it's unestablished, that's asiddha, or inconclusive, anaikantika. So what do these two mean? Well, if an argument is unestablished, that means that its hetu is unestablished in the subject. Its hetu does not exist in the subject. So if this is a smoke-fire inference, what would it mean if that fire inference is unestablished?
There is a smoke on mountain.
Exactly. It would mean there is no smoke on the mountain. Exactly. Yeah, word for word, perfect. So if an argument is unestablished, that means the first premise is untrue. To say that an argument is unestablished is to challenge its first premise. So I chose this picture because I thought the clouds looked a little bit like mist. So let's say you're looking at this scene with a friend, and your friend says, oh look, there's some fire on the mountain. If your friend says that, then you could say to them, the inference you've just carried out in order to arrive at that conclusion is unestablished. Its hetu is unestablished in its subject. Then your friend would probably hit you for being so pompous. But if you do say that, the way to establish whether the inference is unestablished or not is to find out whether that is mist or smoke. Now let's move on to the second way in which an argument can be fallacious. It can be inconclusive. That means the second premise is untrue. So what does that mean if the smoke-fire inference is inconclusive? Anyone?
That it doesn't follow that whatever possesses smoke possesses fire.
Exactly. It's not true that whatever possesses smoke possesses fire. In other words, smoke sometimes occurs without fire. How could that be true? On what interpretation could that be true? Well, we could say we're defining smoke not as that which is caused by fire, but to include things like that which is given off by dry ice. Then we have an example of smoke without fire. After all, dry ice machines are called smoke machines. So if an argument is inconclusive, that means the hetu sometimes occurs without the sadhya. And if the hetu sometimes occurs without the sadhya, that means the hetu's presence is not conclusive evidence of the sadhya's presence. That's why this fault is called being inconclusive. Okay, so we can now turn to a passage in this text, Nyaya Manjari. It can be translated as Blossoms of Reasoning, written at the end of the 9th century by Jayanta in Kashmir. So Jayanta, just like the author I was speaking about 2 weeks ago, Ramakanta, was from Kashmir. Although Jayanta's ancestors only moved to Kashmir from Bengal a few generations before Jayanta. So what inference does Jayanta give of the existence of God? He chooses this inference. Earth, etc. are effects. The word for effect is karya. Whatever is an effect has a maker. What's the conclusion that validly follows from that?
There is a maker.
There is a maker? Anyone else?
The earth has a maker.
Yeah, so a bit more specific. Earth, etc. have a maker. So what is the subject of this inference? Subject in this technical sense of paksha.
Earth.
Yeah, earth, etc. What is the hetu?
Karta?
No.
The effect?
No. Well, yes, a bit, almost. So the hetu is the property of being an effect. Yeah. And what's the sadhya? Yeah, or strictly speaking, the property of having a maker. Now, so this section that we'll be looking at of the Nyayamanjari is the section in which Jayanta deals with the existence of God. It begins with the atheist putting forward that inference, and then the theist putting forward that inference of the existence of God. Then the atheist replies rather damningly that this inference is unestablished, inconclusive, and contradictory. So we've seen what the first two mean. We'll get to contradictory later. What does it mean for this God inference to be unestablished? This is the God inference. What does it mean if this inference is unestablished?
That it is not proven that earth, etc. are effects.
Exactly. If it's unestablished, that means earth, etc. are not effects. Because to be unestablished is for the hetu, being an effect, not to be established in the subject, earth, etc. Now, that's a slightly strange thing for the atheist to say. Why are earth, etc. not effects? Etc., when it's filled out, is filled out with things like earth, mountains, trees, oceans. These are all conglomerations of atoms, according to the physics of the day. And usually conglomerations of atoms are thought to be effects, the effect of the coming together of those atoms. An effect, and the word effect, karya, is often used in these texts just to mean something that comes into existence at a particular time, rather than something that has existed beginninglessly. So it's a bit puzzling why the atheist feels entitled to claim that earth, etc. are not effects. I think the explanation is that this word karya, which I'm translating as effect, could be translated as something that is made. Well, if karya is being understood as something that is made, then insofar as that carries with it the concept of possessing a maker, insofar as being made entails having a maker, then the atheist will want to challenge that earth, etc., are effects in that sense. Because for the atheist, these naturally occurring things, they do have causes, but they don't have makers. They come into existence naturally, spontaneously, or at least through natural causes, without having a conscious maker who oversees that process of creation. So I think when the atheist says that earth, etc., are not effects, the atheist is probably denying that they're not effects in the sense of things which are made. Why might the atheist think that the theist is meaning effect in that sense? Well, because the atheist will deny that whatever is an effect has a maker. Because for the atheist, as I just said, naturally occurring effects have causes, but they don't have makers. They don't come into existence as a result of the promptings of a sentient agent. So for the atheist, this second premise will simply be incorrect, will simply be false, if effect simply means effect in the weak sense of anything that comes into existence. So the atheist will consider the second premise to be untrue if effect just means something that comes into existence. Therefore, if the theist wants to make that second premise true, it looks like, from the point of view of the atheist, they'll have to interpret... from the atheist point of view, if the theist is going to make this argument work, the theist is going to have to be using effects in the sense of being made. Only if, from the atheist point of view, only if the theist uses effect in the sense of something that is made, will we be able to get this conclusion that Earth, etc., have a maker. So I think that is probably why the theist here is denying that Earth, etc., are effects. Now, the second way in which the argument can be false is if it's inconclusive. Here's the argument again on the right. What would it mean for this argument to be inconclusive? People remember what an inconclusive argument is?
So it's not the case that, always the case that whatever is an effect has a maker.
Exactly. To say that an argument is inconclusive challenges the second premise, so it's not true that whatever is an effect has a maker. In other words, some effects do not have a maker. If it's true that some effects do not have a maker, you can see why the argument is inconclusive, because that means being an effect is not conclusive evidence for possessing a maker. So how does the atheist argue that some effects do not have a maker? Well, they give the example of wild grass, some uncultivated grass that just springs up in the wild. That doesn't have a maker, but it is an effect. It comes into being at a certain time. It's not been there eternally. So wild grass illustrates the co-presence of the Hetu and the Sadhya. Wild grass illustrates that something can possess the Hetu but not the Sadhya, because it's an effect but it doesn't have a maker. Now, how can things not just get stuck here with the atheist saying... So the atheist response here is to say, no, wild grass does have a maker, its maker is God.
The theist,
thank you, I always get them confused. This is not good for giving a talk like this. The theist says that wild grass does have a maker. So how can the conversation just not get stuck here with the theist saying wild grass has a maker, namely God, and the atheist saying wild grass doesn't have a maker? Well, the atheist responds to this claim that wild grass has a maker, namely God, by saying, well, no one perceives this maker. The theist then says, well, that's not evidence for something not existing. I've never perceived the maker of this table. Doesn't mean the maker doesn't have a table. I can infer that it doesn't mean the table... I should have had an extra cup of coffee. Doesn't mean that the table doesn't have a maker just because I can't perceive the maker. Well, then the atheist says, yeah, but that's because you weren't around there at the time that the table was created. But you can be around at the time that some wild grass springs up. You can be there right when the first shoot emerges out of the ground, or you could set up some recording equipment under the ground to see the moment when the seed first germinates, and if you did that, you wouldn't see any maker. So the theist accepts that and said, yeah, you wouldn't, but that's because God is imperceptible. And if something is imperceptible, then you can't conclude from not perceiving them that they don't exist. I can't perceive the atoms of oxygen between me and you in the room. As I breathe out, I can't perceive the carbon dioxide molecules. But as a result of my not perceiving them, it doesn't follow they don't exist because they're imperceptible. So at this point, the atheist says, well, wild grass has known causes. We know that wild grass is caused by the seed, the earth surrounding it, the moisture in the earth. Since we have those known causes, then if you're going to say we have to also add some imperceptible cause, then you're violating a widely shared principle about how we should operate with regard to causation, a principle articulated, for example, by Dharmakirti, who says that when known observable cause for some effect are there, when we know that something is caused by a few observable things, it's never justified to postulate in addition to that some imperceptible thing. Otherwise, we'd lose control over what it's justifiable to postulate as the cause of any effect. We could postulate any number of imperceptible things as the cause of everything, of anything. So, I now have to introduce the trirupya theory. This is the theory that for an argument to be valid, its hetu must fulfill three conditions. The first condition it must fulfill is that it must exist in the subject. If it exists in the subject, then the argument is not unestablished. Yeah? Because for an argument to be unestablished is simply for the hetu not to exist in the subject. So if the hetu exists in the subject, we can know the argument is not unestablished. Now these are conditions 2 and conditions 3. The hetu must exist in the set of similar cases, and it must not exist in the set of dissimilar cases. We'll see in a minute what that means. But first, how do these three conditions that the hetu must fulfill line up with the two ways in which an argument can be invalid? Well, we've seen that if the first condition is not fulfilled, that means the argument is not unestablished. That means if the first condition is fulfilled, that means the argument is established. And for the argument to be not inconclusive, we need both of these two conditions to be fulfilled. We'll now look at what these two conditions mean. But just remember that we need those two conditions being fulfilled for the argument to be conclusive, for it to not be inconclusive. So condition 2 is that the hetu must exist in the set of similar cases, where similar cases are defined as all those places other than the subject where the sadhya is found. So in the case of the fire inference, that means all places apart from the mountain where there is fire. And the third condition is that the hetu must not exist in the set of dissimilar cases, where dissimilar cases are defined as all those places other than the subject where the sadhya is not found. So the definition of the dissimilar cases is exactly the same as the definition of the similar cases, except we have to add in a not as the penultimate word. So in the case of the fire inference, the dissimilar cases come out as all places apart from the mountain where there is no fire. Now, you probably haven't totally taken that in yet, but that's going to be illustrated now by a sequence of these diagrams, where the next few slides will all have this exact format with a big rectangle consisting of three smaller rectangles. The rectangle on the left will be the subject, top right is the similar cases, bottom right is the dissimilar cases. And you'll remember that the definition of the similar and dissimilar cases included the phrase other than the subject. So what I've written here is actually shorthand. Things that are on fire is shorthand for things other than the mountain that are on fire. Things that are not on fire means things other than the mountain that are not on fire. So that means that the whole universe is contained within this large rectangle. Everything in the universe will have to exist in one of these three boxes. It's a kind of Venn diagram with three non-overlapping categories, which collectively comprises the whole universe. Because everything in the universe will either be the mountain, or if it's not the mountain, it will either be on fire or not on fire. And if we want an argument to be valid, then the ticks and crosses indicating the presence or absence of the hetu must be in this form. We must have a tick there, and a cross there. because that's the three conditions that must be fulfilled by a valid hetu. Must exist in the subject, exist among the similar cases, and not exist among the dissimilar cases. It doesn't have to exist in all the similar cases, it just has to exist in one or more, but it must be absent from all the dissimilar cases. Yeah, maybe we should just pause to consider, why is it the case that for an argument to be conclusive, we have to have the second and the third condition fulfilled? Why is it the case that for an argument to be conclusive, for the second premise to be true, we have to have a tick there and a cross there? Well, if we didn't have a cross there, if we had a tick there, meaning that smoke is present among things that are not on fire, that would mean we would have smoke present in the absence of fire, which would mean smoke would not be conclusive evidence for the existence of fire. Why do we need to have a tick there for the argument to be not inconclusive? Well, imagine that there was a cross there. What would that mean? That would mean that smoke is not found in connection with things that are not on fire, and it's also not found in connection with things that are on fire. So that would mean there's no smoke in the universe apart from on the mountain. So you've just seen the smoke on the mountain, that's the first time you've ever seen smoke. Obviously, in that case, since you've never experienced smoke in association with fire, then you're not going to be able to say wherever there is smoke, there is fire. Now, as I said, if the first condition is not fulfilled, so we have the hetu absent from the subject, that means the argument is unestablished. That would be the case where there's actually mist, not fire. What would it mean for the God inference to be unestablished? Well, we saw that the claim there was that earth, etc., are not effects. In other words, being in effect doesn't actually exist in earth, etc. Now, in a case where we have ticks here, the three conditions, the condition two and three of the trirupya theory, both of them have not been fulfilled. Condition two has been fulfilled, condition three has not been fulfilled, because condition three was the hetu must be absent from the dissimilar cases. So in that case, since we have smoke occurring both with things that are on fire, but also with things that are not on fire, smoke does not give conclusive evidence for the existence of fire. And again, how could that be the case? Well, if we're defining smoke to include smoke caused from dry ice. How was the God inference claimed to be inconclusive? Well, the example there was given of wild grass. So which of these three small boxes would wild grass fit in? Yeah. Wild grass is not earth, etc. Wild grass is not something that has a maker. Wild grass fits here. It lacks a maker. Once we've established that wild grass exists here, we can then ask, is wild grass an effect? Yeah, everyone agrees that wild grass is an effect. So you have the presence of the hetu being an effect among the dissimilar cases, so the argument is inconclusive. Now, that's all about the two main ways in which an argument can be invalid, unestablished and inconclusive. But you'll remember from the earlier slide that Jayanta's atheist is claiming that this inference is also contradictory. What does it mean for an inference to be contradictory? It means you have a cross there and a tick there. So it means that the hetu is completely absent from the similar cases, but is present among the dissimilar cases. That means the hetu never occurs along with the sadhya, but it does occur in the absence of the sadhya. So that means the hetu actually proves the complete opposite to what it was intended to prove. The hetu actually proves the absence of the sadhya. So this charge also challenges the truth of the second premise, but it claims it to be even more radically false than in an inconclusive inference. In a valid inference, the Hetu conclusively establishes the Sadhya. In an inconclusive inference, the Hetu neither establishes the Sadhya nor the absence of the Sadhya. In a contradictory inference, the Hetu establishes the absence of the Sadhya, the complete opposite of what it's intended to prove. So how can the atheist claim that the God inference is contradictory? Well, the atheist points out that even if the conclusion of the inference is true, that Earth, etc., have a maker, God has still not been proved. All that's been proved is that Earth, etc., have a maker, but it hasn't been proved that that maker is godlike, i.e. omniscient, omnipotent, disembodied, not subject to karma, not subject to suffering. So the theist, in response to this worry, might be tempted to add some qualifiers, visheshanas, to the sadhya. The theist might be tempted to say, okay, well, the sadhya is not just possession of a maker, it's possession of a maker who is omniscient, omnipotent, disembodied, not subject to karma, not subject to suffering. But if the theist does that, I have a feeling in the last sentence I again said atheist where I meant theist. If the theist does that, if the theist is tempted to add these qualifiers to the sadhya, then the similar cases become things that have an omniscient maker, the dissimilar cases become things that lack an omniscient maker. Now, which of these three rectangles will we... In which of these three will we include human-made artifacts like pots, houses, tables? Huh? Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, exactly. So human artifacts are going to be included here, let's say pots and houses, because they're neither earth nor do they have an omniscient maker. Potters and builders are not omniscient or disembodied. So, we've established that pots and houses exist among the dissimilar cases. Then we have to ask, are pots and houses effects? Yes, of course. So we have the presence of the Hetu being in effect among the dissimilar cases. Now, what happens to the similar cases? Unless one's already a committed theist, that will be an empty set. The atheist will not accept that there's anything that has an omniscient maker. So the similar cases will be an empty set. There'll be nothing that exists in that set. So there will be no effects in that set. So being an effect will be absent. So we'll have a tick there and a cross there, which means this inference with its modified sadhya, with its sadhya modified in order to escape the previous problem, now ends up proving the opposite of what the theist wants. It proves that Earth, etc., lack an omniscient maker. Okay, now I said at the beginning that I was going to try and keep everyone on board. I haven't fooled myself into thinking that everyone will have understood everything and followed all the details of these diagrams. But two things. One is just to say that I have actually already published an article that includes all of this and includes all of what will be in the lecture in week 5 and a bit more. So if anyone wants that, I can send that. You can see the written version. But also, what I'll do now, the last thing, is I'll just summarise the important points without using any of the logical terminology and without appealing to these diagrams. So at the beginning of this section, Jayanta, writing in the voice, in his own voice, Jayanta is a theist, he puts forward his inference of the existence of God, which has two premises, earth, etc., are effects. Whatever is an effect has a maker, and so its conclusion is earth, etc., have a maker. Then the atheist starts speaking. Jayanta articulates, puts himself into the voice of the atheist, comes up with what he sees as the strongest possible arguments against this inference. And there are three charges that the atheist comes up with. First of all, that the argument is subject to the fault of being unestablished. That means that it's not actually the case that earth, etc., are effects. So we have the truth of the first premise challenged. Secondly, that the argument is inconclusive. So the truth of the second premise is challenged. It's not the case that whatever is an effect has a maker, because things like wild grass are naturally occurring, they're effects, but they lack a maker. And then we have this contradictory point. Now let me explain what's going on here without reference to these trirupya diagrams. And the point can be clarified by thinking of this argument as an argument from an analogy. It is an argument from analogy in the sense that it begins with a certain sample set. It points out that all of the things in that sample set share a property, then extrapolates that property to a new sample set. What do I mean by that? In what way does the God inference conform to that pattern? Well, it starts with the set of human-made artifacts, pots, buildings, tables. We can observe that all of them have makers, potter, builder, carpenter. We can observe that for all of those, they possess this property of being in effect as a result of having a maker. And so then when we move to the second sample set of naturally occurring phenomena like earth and trees and mountains and oceans, we can see that they too are effects. So we extrapolate the property of having a maker to this new sample set, even though we can't perceive the maker in the second sample set. So that's how the argument works, as an argument from analogy. But the problem is that if we do that, in arguments from analogy, you can only transfer a property that you observe in the original sample set. And the property you observe in the original sample set is having a maker who is not omniscient, who's not disembodied, who is subject to karma, who is subject to suffering. And so you end up proving a maker who is embodied, subject to karma, subject to suffering, not omniscient, not omnipotent. So the atheist might be tempted, in order to avoid that problem, to include certain qualifiers in the property that gets transferred and claim that the property that is to be transferred is actually possessing a maker that is omniscient, omnipotent, etc. But the problem with that is that in arguments from analogy, you can only transfer a property that actually exists in the sample set. And in the sample set, you don't have this property of having a maker who is omniscient or permanently blissful. We've all encountered grumpy builders, carpenters. So that has set things up so that we now have all of the sort of logical apparatus in place, that next week we can see how Jayanta very ingeniously answers all of these objections and establishes God's existence. Okay.